Here at Georgian Partners, we spend a lot of time thinking about how computing systems can be leveraged to better communicate with people using natural language. And while some may expect it to be a pretty simple exercise that could be solved using machine learning, the reality is it's hugely complicated. That's because language is nuanced, complex, and constantly evolving. That means for machines to fully understand language, they have to do more than simply parse words. We've got to get to a deeper understanding of the intent behind those words, and maybe even the people who said them. Today, we're going to have a discussion that takes place at the intersection of psychology, communications, and technology. We're going to try to figure out how machines can better understand language by looking at how humans learn and how humans communicate with language. I'm John Pryl. Welcome to the Impact Podcast. Joining me is Afsana Fazli, a professor at the University of Toronto. She was recently promoted to Director of Research at Thomson Reuters. Afsana holds a PhD in computer science from UT, but we're talking to her today because she thinks a lot about applying that computer science knowledge to linguistics and the psychology of language. Always bridging academia and business, Afsana has built data science teams from the ground up. She's worked at companies that do classic extraction of insights from big data, from linguistics, and more. Welcome to the show, Afsana.
Happy to be here.
What do you think it means bringing together this computational linguistics, which is kind of NLP, and this whole cognitive psychology or cognitive science piece? So for you, what does it mean to bring those two pieces together?
To me, you know, the focus of artificial intelligence as a super field and natural language processing or computational linguistics as a subfield of artificial intelligence has been mainly to build systems and machines that can learn to speak, basically communicate with humans the way we communicate with each other. And if we want to do that, there is no way around it. And we have to really understand how we are communicating with each other as humans. Doesn't mean that we necessarily are going to simulate exactly the same mechanism. For one, that's just too hard. We still don't know exactly how we communicate and what are the underlying cognitive processes when we are producing a sentence or we are trying to understand a sentence that our communication partner is producing at the time. So we can get a lot of insights about first how to make machines and systems that can do the same thing, not necessarily at the same level, but also it gets us to appreciate the difficulty of the task. And then it sets our expectations right about what kinds of machines and systems we can generate and build. Just understand that it is almost impossible, at least today, to generate a system or build a system that can act even at the same level as a five-year-old in terms of their language understanding.
So as we learn, we have to begin to think more about, this is really some of the basic hygiene of natural language processing, even before we get to some of the psychology of these things. One thing I saw in a presentation you were part of, words have attributes. I hadn't really thought about it till I saw a chart that was up that said, you know, milk, it's also white, it's also a liquid, it's also nourishing. How does that begin to even get defined in a computer science system? How do you even begin to start with some of the basic hygiene to understand?
So the more traditional approaches to word meaning and to understanding and modeling word meaning within a computer system has been trying to actually capture those as very explicit properties, like as you mentioned. So every word has certain properties and we try to build it in as some sort of a knowledge that is built in. So for the most part, we can't really try to learn that from the environment because for humans, again, we learn those properties naturally from the environment, but it's not just from the linguistic input. It's also mostly from the non-linguistic input that is available to us as humans when we're being exposed to a language. For machines, it's harder because if you're just providing linguistic input, they can learn a lot about word meanings, but that kind of word meaning is different. So in order to understand what the word milk means, we would look at all the different usages of this word and look at the words that appear with the word milk within the same sentence or phrase, and then try to capture that, summarize that into what the word milk means.
So I just want to understand that correctly. So now we're building, I guess it's a lexicon of some sort of word meanings. That's really just to get, you're not ready at sentences. You're not even at context yet. You're really just parsing the pieces that you're being fed. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. So one of the building blocks of any natural language processing system is to understand what words mean. And of course, we make the assumption that if we understand what words mean, because sentences, for the most part, are compositional, and the meaning of a sentence is composed of the meanings of the components of the sentence, which are the words. If we understand word meanings and we can have a good model of word meanings, we can probably have a relatively good model of sentence meaning. I mean, there's a big assumption there, but it actually works in many cases. If we're not thinking about idioms and metaphors and all sorts of other nuances of language, this is going to be useful.
Some of the word meanings are easier, but there are other elements of what words mean that have almost another level of complexity or a different type of nuance. And whether people say, I think I know something or I wish, take me through your thoughts on words. I'm not even sure how you define those words, but think, know, and wish are very different than yet. Well, sort of the same. So how do you manage something like that?
That's a very interesting question. And in fact, in some of the work I did with a PhD student at the University of Toronto, we focused on those verbs exactly. And the focus was on trying to understand how children learn the meanings of those words. Because as you said, there's a lot of nuances of meaning in some word like think or know or wish. These verbs are, there are two categories of these verbs. Like the word like think or know are called belief verbs because...
Okay, belief, like it, okay.
They're talking about your beliefs. And bear me with that. I mean, there's another meaning for this, but in their usual meaning, they're belief verbs. And then there's these other words like...
I'm good with you saying simple, by the way, for me. This is good. As simple as okay.
That's good. So, and the other group that you mentioned, wish and want and need, these are referred to as desire verbs. And children produce a lot of interesting patterns in their understanding and producing of these verbs. First of all, these seem to be some of the hardest verbs for children to learn. And for that reason, there's a lot of studies in psychology on that. One of the reasons that people have focused on is that especially the belief verbs, there's this notion of theory of mind, and that is connected to the understanding of the meaning of belief verbs. What it is that there is a point in time where when children, realize that their beliefs could be different from their parents' beliefs, other people's beliefs. And they could even be different from the reality. Because before that, they think that whatever they think is the same thing as everybody else thinks, and that's actually the reality. So let's say if I put a toy in a red box while you're out of the room, when you come in the room, let's say before I did this, you were in the room, and I put the toy in a blue bin. Then you leave the room. While you are away, you're not in the room, somebody else comes in the room and takes the toy out of the blue bin and puts it in the red bin. So the kid is still there. She's making this observation that this is happening. And you come in. If you ask the kid, where do you think John thinks the toy is in? They would say, oh, John thinks it's in the red bin. And at some point, when they are about 3 or 4, of course, this is different from a child to another, but around 3 or 4, that's where they basically have this theory of mind and understanding of, you know what, if you did not observe this event happening, you probably still think that the toy is actually in the blue bin where it was before you left the room. And that is something that affects understanding and learning of these belief verbs.
So I love that as a kind of way to learn this beliefs and knowledge. So let's keep going down this path of psychology. And I'd love if you could talk to me a little bit, since we're talking about belief. People that, and I want to go to facts and news and fact extraction versus fact checking versus understanding your sources. Why? I mean, you need a lot of this training to kind of get to that, but how do you begin to think about analyzing that? Again, you're trying to understand a set of customers, and we'll talk about application shortly. So how do you deal with that level of knowledge and understanding what are facts and truth and that kind of stuff?
That's a very good question. And that's one of the hardest things, right? So again, you know, I always say we now have very high expectations of what machines can do for us. But as you learn about all these nuances of meaning and these fascinating patterns that we observe in how children learn language, or even how we communicate to each other as adults. So then you realize that, you know what? Yeah, exactly what you said. Oh, okay. Then how do you deal with, you know, understanding text in terms of understanding what are the facts and what is the truth? So in a lot of cases, again, as I said, we don't have access to what goes on in the reader's mind or in the writer's mind when they wrote that story. The only thing we have access to, which is very limited, is just the language, the word. So we try to make the best use of it when we are trying to extract facts, for example, from a piece of news, let's say. And then in a lot of those cases, we rely on the statistics to help us in that direction.
So where does one start to get this?
Of course, there's also clues in the text. So for example, if somebody says, I think, and then something, versus when they say, I know, and there's something, versus when they say, oh, some so-and-so said something, there is differences. So we take these clues from text, of course, to tell us a little bit about how likely it is that this expression after said, or I think, or I know, or somebody else knows, or they think, is a fact or not, and the truth level of it. But we also try to get evidence from other sources. So let's say, you know, about news. If there are many different news sources and many different people or who are narrating the news source, this particular story, if they're talking about the same kinds of facts, let's say an event happened, somebody said an event happened, we want to know whether it actually happened or they're just making it up. We would look at the different sources. And if there is more, you know, a lot of evidence for some particular event happening, then we say, you know, it's probably true that this actually happened. And it's probably accurate that, you know, these are the circumstances, dates, location, and the outcomes.
Do you see it being different and understanding what's being said in like legal versus finance or any other domains?
Yes, that's again one of the other things. And especially when you move to these professional domains, as opposed to general domain like news, for example, you know, the legal text is very different from what you see in the financial domain or from what you see in the tax domain, for example, or in some like in the health domain, for example. And we do need to have a good understanding of these domain specific nuances of meaning. So in a lot of cases, again, when we work with the statistical models, what needs to be done is that you need to build maybe the same statistical model, but on different data from the different domains. And that would give you some advantage and that would be able to capture some of these differences across the domains. But that's not enough. We also always need to constantly talk to the professionals who know the domain, like lawyers in the legal domain, for example, or if you're building something for healthcare practitioners, you really need to understand the world from, see the world from their perspective and try to understand what they need and how they interpret a piece of text when they read it. And then that helps you build better models.
Is that a training element or is it something different for you to build? When you're building your models, do you need to interview, say, the healthcare professionals beforehand or do they become part of a training system? I do need to understand how a nurse or a doctor will interpret certain things. And it seems to me that before you even build your models, you need to get that underlying linguistic hygiene correct. And then you could build models on top of it. Is that fair to position it that way?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, again, if you ask different people might have different opinions, but that's how I think about it. I think that there has to be some good understanding of the domain, but then that's not something that you can just do in before you start your modeling or your training and then you just move on. Basically, it has to be this constant relationship and constant interaction as you are building the models.
Right. And we often talk about if we're building a team that's going to develop a new product set, it doesn't just come out of a data scientist. You need, we need a classic product management function. You need to bring the business side to the table. You need to bring the customer side to the table of obviously the developers and pull it all together otherwise. But this is interesting to me because there's a nuance to this I hadn't really thought about. I think that's what's intriguing to our audience in terms of it is much more complex to get it right, to understand what's happening on the around these words. So with all that then, what do you see as some of the bigger challenges the companies are facing, and what should they be doing about them?
Yeah, so again, you know, it seems like today everything we do is to address two things. One is that there is the information overload, so there's too much information out there, and we try to summarize it or filter it for the audience to make it easier and more accessible to the audience. And the other thing is that, you know, this is also related to the information overload. We're basically just fighting for, you know, human attention. We're all like businesses, because we're all producing products or generating things and content, and we're all just, we want their attention, and there's just not enough of it now. So in order to get that, I think one of the things that some companies have started looking into, and it's also in academia, is a field that's called sentiment analysis. And the goal there is that you want to be able to sort of summarize the sentiment of audience. Let's say if, you know, you have access to thousands and thousands of reviews for a movie, and you really want to know what every single person thinks before you make your decision whether you want to see that movie or not. I mean, of course, we don't have time to go through 1,000 reviews and read every one of them and make a decision. But if some machine or some system can summarize that for you and tells you, okay, you know, this movie has these aspects, which are the cast, the length, the visual appeal, or the actors and actresses and other aspects of the movie. I'll try to sort of categorize these reviews in terms of which one of these aspects they're talking about. And therefore, any of these aspects, I'll tell you, 50% of the 1,000 reviews are positive about this aspect, and 20% are negative, and then the rest of the 30% are neutral.
I like that. I like the key, because it's changing the, it's not an overall review. Maybe it's important. Maybe the cinematography matters to me, or the plot matters to me. So I don't think we've seen that yet. I think that's a great set of kind of ability to trust or get a level of comfort with the data that you're reading. Yeah, so I really like this in terms of us doing a better job of understanding and maybe trusting the information we have. You know, you work for Thomson Reuters. There's a fintech product out there called Icon that allows individuals and consumers and businesses to kind of get a better feel for the data that they're seeing, and they can trust the data that's being presented to them. Kind of what is that a good extension of where we've gone from the movie metaphor into fintech? Can you talk a little bit about how that might work?
Yeah, generally what we do at Thomson Reuters, whether we are working for in the context of fintech, or whether we are working in the context of legal or other products that Thomson Reuters has for different professionals like tax, accounting, financial, and risk domains, it's all about trust, as you mentioned. And it's all about providing trusted answers to professionals. And so basically the goal is that we know that in this era, again, I repeat that, there is this problem of information load, even for professionals. And they need to have access to information that is accurate, so they can trust that and they can be sure that they're not missing something extremely important, or they're not giving information that is really fake or not trusted. And at the same time, they want this information to be filtered for them. So we need to remove redundant pieces of information. And this is done sort of in a semi-automatically fashion. So what we do is we always say we're not trying to replace lawyers or replace financial advisors or replace accountants, but we're trying to empower them by helping them do their job better. And that is where we come into, you know, our products. Basically, that's the focus, is the products are all about filtering irrelevant pieces of information, personalizing information for the particular people who are using these products, and giving them what they need. And again, ensuring that they can trust the information they're receiving.
I think that's a great way to wrap this up. In order for a person to trust a machine, there needs to be a level of understanding that goes way beyond simply getting the words right. Machines need to understand the intent behind those words. And to do that, they often need to deeply understand the technology around logistics with a chunk of psychology thrown in. For the Impact Podcast, I'm John Pryor. Thanks for listening. If you like what we're doing, we'd appreciate your telling other people about the show. Better yet, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or write a review. Doing so will really help ensure that more people can find us. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Impact Podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you go to find your podcasts.